The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Or you can text to 51551. Now, over the years, my next guest has tackled the topics of love, sex, family, work and more. His talk entitled Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person went viral around the globe. And now philosopher Alain de Botton is back with a new book called The School of Life and Emotional Education. And he's live from London right now. Good afternoon, Alain.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. The School of Life, I was describing it as a handbook for life. So there's an awful lot in it. Is this sort of a culmination of everything you've thought about and written about over the years?
Pretty much. It's a Bible. It's an anthology. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all here.
Yes.
It's all here.
I was saying that to call something a handbook for life is a sort of a grandiose claim, isn't it?
Look, it is. But one of the things that we definitely are very keen on at the School of Life is that no life is perfect, can be made perfect. No one knows everything. We're all stumbling around pretty much in the darkness. And this shouldn't be seen as a kind of a pessimistic thing. You know, the more we can accept that, the more we can accept that, as the church used to say, we're broken. By the way, that's not a bad idea. If people can say, I'm imperfect, I don't know it all, I'm ignorant and I'm a bit scared, that's a really good basis for friendship, for connection, for, you know, in a way, setting your expectations correctly of what it means to live in the world. So yes, we've got high ambitions, but we also know that a good enough life is a good life.
But all of those things you just said, society would see traditionally as weaknesses. I'm flawed, I'm all those things.
Yeah, but I think, you know, acknowledging that life can't be made perfect, strangely, is one of the first ways in which your mood can lift. At the School of Life, we sometimes gather people and we say to them, you know, it's normal to have problems. And people, you can just visibly see people going, oh, wow, I didn't know. and you know, religions have always known this. I mean, take the Buddhists, you know, the first tenet of Buddhism is life is suffering. Now, that could sound depressing. It isn't, because a lot of what depresses us is the spirit of the modern world, which keeps insisting madly that it's normal to have a perfect love life, a perfect sex life, a perfect work life, a perfect family life. And we're all, you know, turning around going, what's wrong with me? Why hasn't this come true for me? And, you know, part of the problem is that everybody's slightly lying to everybody else, thinking, you know, I know that the show's not the way it's meant to be for me, but maybe it is for other people, so I'm just going to pretend. And so we've got this sort of giant construction. And, you know, that's in a way why friendship matters so much. In this book, I talk a lot about friendship. What friendship really is, which is connection around the bad stuff. And, you know, a lot of the time we meet each other with a giant wall. And the more we can take that wall down, particularly, I should say, men, the more men can take that wall down, the easier connection becomes.
Yeah, because there's a theme running through the book about sort of, I would describe it, you don't describe it like this, of lifting the lid on our thoughts. That we a lot goes on in our heads that we don't share with anybody, even our closest, you know, our partner, our wife, our husband, or whoever. We don't share with anybody.
That's right. And, you know, part of the problem is that we know ourselves from the inside, but we know other people only from what they choose to tell us, which tends to be a very abbreviated version of the truth. So the result is that most of us, but all of us, think of ourselves as very weird and unusual. We're not. We just don't know enough about other people. And I think the role of art, literature, cinema, you know, books in general, art in general, is to try and get a picture of what other people are like and what life is like that's actually truer to the facts. I mean, when people talk about, you know, why are relationships nice? One of the things that's good about relationships is not just personal relationships, but close relationships, is that finally you can let down your guard and admit what being alive actually means, which is very different from the adverts.
Mm. Well, let's talk about sort of relationships as in, you know, seeking out somebody that you want to live the rest of your life with. Let's start at the end then, and marriage. Is marriage fit for purpose? Is it a construct that maybe religion and society have enforced on us that maybe is outmoded?
You know, it's only been for the last 150 years, which is really the last minute in evolutionary terms, that we've tried to marry for love. I mean, nowadays, we all expect that, yes, there may be children, yes, there may be finances and a household to run, but the whole engine of a marriage is emotional closeness. Now, that's very new, and we're still waking up to the implications of that. And broadly speaking, we're very bad at that. I mean, I think really, really happy marriages, I think we're below 20% on the statistics, you know. And that's not to say, to mention all the you know, the divorce statistics. So it's a rare thing. It's a work of art. It's a work of luck, and it's a blessing, if you like. Now, what we're trying to do at the School of Life is, can we improve on those numbers? Can we teach love? Can we suggest that love isn't just an emotion, it's a skill? And is it a skill that we can learn? And I think it is. You know, a lot of the way in which we can get better at love is understanding, sounds weird, our childhoods. Because the way that we love as adults is hugely rooted in the way that we were loved and experienced love as children. Now, from one point of view, this is ridiculous. This is humiliating. You know, you could be 30, 40, 50, 60, and you're telling me that, you know, the way I was when I was five is determining my relationship? And the bad news is, yes, absolutely. And the best way to get on top of this is not to run away from this idea, but simply to understand how the way that you are emotionally owes its nature to the way in which things were for you when you were very young. And most of us don't have a clue.
Okay, so is this about sort of examining things that trigger certain behaviours and trying to trace them back to, you know, the way we were with our parents, the way we were with our siblings? Is that it?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the weirdest but in fact most fascinating things to study is, how do people get instinctively excited by some people and instinctively turned off by other people? It's very weird. And people say, oh, I've got a type, etc. And people say, you know, I like brown hair or blonde hair, etc. But really, we all have a psychological type. And the psychological type is firmly rooted in childhood experience, often, almost always, in ways in which we don't understand. So, you know, you'll see people saying things like, you know, I like people who are a little bit distant, bit of a challenge. And what that really means is that maybe for them, love early on was associated not just with care and kindness, but with a feeling of not being enough for somebody, a feeling of needing to impress someone or persuade them that you're a worthy human being. Now, that's a dynamic that can chase you throughout your life, can lead to, you know, picking very unusual partners. We're very bad at choosing partners because we insist on choosing them by instinct, and we don't understand how our instincts are formed because, as I say, they rest on childhood experience.
And you give sort of pointers there. You're not a big fan of romance, and you say that the more romantic you feel that the beginning of a relationship is, the more dangerous it might turn out to be. Something to that effect.
I think many of the things that we say, oh, that sounds a bit unromantic, actually turn out to be precisely the things that we need to be doing in order to make relationships work. So imagine a couple who on an early dinner date start talking about, you know, household finances. Somebody would go, well, that's not very romantic. But actually, you know, money, as Jane Austen teaches us, is very important and very significant feature in any relationship, and discussing it up front is a very good idea. But not just this. I mean, you know, discussing, for example, you know, how you got on with your parents and what that does to you as a person in your adulthood, that's a really good topic to be discussing. It doesn't sound romantic,
no.
but it is, in the sense that it's conducive to making a relationship work in the long term, and that's true romance.
And of course, we've spoken already, well, you've said already that we're all flawed, and in the flushes of lust and all of that, you think that you've met the perfect person and they're the one. But of course, you know, they are flawed, and what's going to happen over time is that they will reveal their flaws to you.
Now, I mean, you know, it's perfectly fine that things are flawed, and this is where we need to retool the word love, because, you know, here's a funny thing. We know how to love children. Many of us now, you know, we've been taught by psychologists and by the spirit of the times, we know how to love children, but we don't know how to love adults. Imagine you come back from work, you're fed up, you've had a hard day, things are difficult, you've got a kid, they're 2.5 years old, you cook them some supper, you put it down in front of them, and then they look at it for a second, and then, you know, look cross and throw the whole thing on the floor. Now, what are you going to do? Are you going to hit the child? Are you going to say, I can't believe you're doing this to me when my whole life's so hard anyway? No, you're not, because you've learned how to love. And therefore, you're going to start looking around for explanations to explain difficult behavior. You're going to say, maybe the kid's tired. Maybe something's happened that day at nursery or something. Maybe someone's been mean. Maybe the kid's jealous of their sibling or something. But you're going to be looking out for explanations to take the edge of difficult behavior. That is love. Love is, in a way, the courage to look at the trickiest moments in other people's lives and interpret them with generosity. Love isn't just admiring a perfect body and an impressive CV. It is being benevolent towards our humanity, which is a little bit broken, as I said. But no one teaches us this. But that's the work of love.
Do you worry then, because we live in a time where people put forward a sort of an unreal version of themselves, more so than ever before, because they have the wherewithal through social media and filters and apps and all sorts of things to do it. So we're getting further away from our true selves.
Totally. And you know, this leads people to feel, you know, we pick up a lot of this. People come to us with fears of being imposters, you know, what's called imposter syndrome. Mm. And people think, you know, I'm not as impressive, I'm not as intelligent, I'm not as beautiful as everybody else. Now, the classic way of solving this problem, most people, if you read like the classic self-help book, they'll say to you things like, no, hang on a minute, you are beautiful, you are amazing, believe in yourself, etc. Now, I think this is disastrous. I think this only actually perpetuates the problem. The way I like to do it is to say, hang on a minute, you suspect that you might be a bit of an idiot, you suspect that you make mistakes and errors. Well, here's the truth. You are an idiot. Just accept this. But here's the big but. We live on a planet of 7 billion idiots.
We're all idiots.
We are all idiots. Yeah. And far from this being a depressing fact, this is the basis of generosity, of sympathy, of friendship. It's the beginning of redemption. Because once we accept this fact and look at it head on with generosity, we won't be, you know, trying to avoid it in the middle of the night and sort of glimpsing and thinking, oh my God, does anyone know that I'm an idiot? Just accept that with good grace. Of course you're an idiot. And that's just what human beings are.
Yeah. Just on the social media thing and influencers and all that. And I worry that young people now are creating their sense of self is this virtual self that they have, and their pictures and their likes and their Instagram feed and all that sort of thing. And how is that going to pan out then, you know, when they become adults?
You know, I think...
Because traditionally, how was our sense of self created?
Well, it was created by being seen by another person. You know, all of us. I mean, think of a baby. How does the baby know itself at the very beginning? It's known by being known by others. When you pick up a baby and you go, oh, I think baby's tired now, or I think baby needs some milk now or something, the baby starts to understand itself by the attunement and the generosity of the people looking after it. So that's how we get to understand ourselves. And really that's a way of saying that it's through relationships, not just sexual relationships, but relationships in broadly, that we come to understand ourselves and tolerate ourselves. And for all of social media's power to get us to get acquainted with other people, ultimately what it's all about is a deeper kind of connection, which comes from being probably in the same room, embodied, you know, with our bodies, and being seen and accepted. And that is the Holy Grail. We don't want riches and power and fame. Ultimately, what we want to do, I think most of us, is to be seen and recognized and accepted for who we really are. And it's thrilling. Every time you build a connection with someone, that you're able to be your real self, that is freedom. That is happiness.
But the question, Alan, is: are we ever our real selves with anybody?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, one of the psychoanalysts that I'm really keen on is this fantastic child psychoanalyst, Donald Winnicott, who made a distinction he was writing in the 60s, made a distinction between the true self and the false self. And he basically said that if your childhood goes well, you are able at the beginning to show your true self, which might be rather destructive, rather hostile, rather badly behaved. You're allowed to scream and kick within reason. You're allowed to kind of let it go. He also knew that there is a danger of compliance, of children who are under such pressure to perform, to be good, to fit in with parental expectations, that they become too good too early. They become early compliers, and they develop what he called a false self, which is a very dangerous thing. And in his view, leads a lot of people to mental unwellness in later life, when basically the true self is just looking for a way out. And you suddenly wake up and you're 40 or 50 and you're leading an inauthentic life. You're leading the life that everybody else wants you to lead, but not that you want to lead. And sometimes people, and it can be a sign of health, sometimes people have a breakdown at that point and everybody goes, oh my God, their life's gone wrong. But actually, if you stand back dispassionately, it may be that the life is starting to go right. A breakdown can be a prelude to a breakthrough and the beginning of something more authentic, something more alive, that people are finally going, it's my life and I need to live my life, not the life that everybody else wants me to lead. So that's a slow way in which to look at authenticity.
Just back to relationships for the moment, and you go through the various types of arguments that couples have, and the argument of sex is a huge one. No, or the no sex argument.
And you
say at the end of that, were our species to learn how to solve this, the world would be suddenly and decisively calmer. There would be infinitely fewer fights, alcoholic outbursts, divorces, affairs, rages, denunciations, recriminations, civil wars, armed conflicts, and nuclear conflagrations.
Absolutely. You know, one of the hardest things for couples to do is to admit that they want each other sexually. Because in many relationships, after a while, start to get fractious, and both parties are keen to kind of seem strong. And, you know, often there are real fights about where to spend Christmas, but how much money to spend on a sofa, you know, who's right and who's wrong over an issue. And yet, in couples, we're also trying to do this other thing, which is be naked. I mean, properly, psychologically naked, as it were. And one of the ways in which we do that is through lovemaking. But of course, you know, very often couples stop making love because, this is a key thing, not because they don't want sex, because that's what people get wrong. It's because they're angry, because one or the other is furious with the other one in ways that they haven't been able to explain, because it's so humbling to have to say to somebody, I love you and I need you and I want to have sex with you, and I'm afraid that you don't want me. So very often people don't have that argument. Instead, they have a proxy argument over the milk, over the kids' education, over where to spend the weekend, over how to pronounce a word. And these arguments have inside them all the venom, all the energy, all the pain of this other conversation that hasn't been had, which is essentially circling around the very painful topic of, do you want me? Do you still want me? And if you do want me, why aren't you saying you want me? And this is so hard to say that people will discuss almost anything else other than the
sex.
Pain of intimacy.
And what about diverging libidos? You know, as we, you know, we're in a relationship and at the start,
yeah,
if you're lucky, your libidos correspond.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would like to propose something which I'm sure some of your listeners will probably disagree with. I think that, yes, physically there may be diverging libidos, but that is not any way as significant as diverging emotional warmth. That is the key thing.
Mm.
You know, because
intimacy,
yeah. Diverging levels of trust, ultimately. Mm. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about trust. You cannot have sex with somebody that you don't trust. And oddly, you may end up not trusting your partner. You may share a mortgage with them. You may have three kids with them. You may be spending the rest of your life with them. And yet, emotionally, you don't trust them anymore because they've hurt you, because they're not listening to something you're saying. And one of the responses is, I don't have a libido. It's not the libido you don't have. What you don't have is trust. And trust will follow the libido. You know, if you want to get couples to have sex again, don't bother with candles. Don't bother with, you know, fancy scents and oils. Get them to do the following exercise. Get them to sit together, and one after the other, explain to the other. Firstly, what is it that they resent? What is it? How have you hurt me? If you say to your partner, how have you hurt me? Can I listen? How have I hurt you? How have you hurt me? If you have a kind of a moment when you can just let out the poison, the pain that you've caused, that they've caused, and then if you have a moment of forgiveness, can we forgive each other for the hurts we've caused? That's much greater turn on than bath oil.
Right. That's sound advice. A cautionary tale for people who are... Well, you talk about affairs and you say that the affair starts long before the weekend away through work or whatever, that it's symptomatic of a fractious relationship. But you do say another thing, which you say our partners aren't uniquely damaged. We just know them a lot better than the exciting stranger.
Yes. I mean, okay, so let's start with the first point. I mean, people often think that what causes affairs is runaway horniness, that the people have affairs because they're sexually wanton and out of control. It's not true. People have affairs 99% of the time because they feel disconnected from their partner. right? And in way, as we've just been saying, they feel disconnected in ways they cannot explain. And then along comes a stranger, and it looks like it's about sex, but it's not. It's about, I mean, it could be about revenge. Revenge, essentially, for not having been noticed, for having been taken for granted, for not having been heard. But the thing you really want from the partner, the person you're having an affair with, ultimately is a kind of connection that you're not getting elsewhere. Of course, you know, the person that you're having an affair with is in a much better position than your long-term partner because you don't know them very well. Mm. You know, you know that quip, the best way to get over a crush is to get to know someone better. More you know somebody, the harder it is to have illusions. Now, I think that's too cynical because I think it's possible to know someone very well and love them very deeply. But that certainly a kind of runaway crush could be tempered a little bit by knowledge and certainly by contact. But look, broadly, I think our view of affairs in the modern world is incredibly moralistic in the wrong way. People who have affairs are not bad. They are almost always angry in ways that they've been too immature to get on top of, and they need to learn how to explain their anger and their resentment and not act out their anger as they're currently doing.
You're going to stay with us. The book is The School of Life and Emotional Education. Alan de Botton is going to stay with us. We have to take a quick commercial break. Thanks very much, Alan.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
So Alan de Botton is still with us, the School of Life. Just you've mentioned the School of Life a lot. So it's a group of philosophers, psychologists.
It's a home. It's a home for primarily psychotherapy, also psychology and philosophy. And broadly speaking, it's a kind of self-help organization. We aim to make people happier and less troubled. We have a lot of people who've got relationship troubles who come and see us. We've got a headquarters in London. We've got 10 branches around the world. We've got a YouTube channel. We publish books. We kind of do stuff. And now we've put together our best thoughts in this new book that I've written. And but look, broadly speaking, it's a home for our troubled minds, and you know we're all troubled because being alive is an emergency, and so so it's for everybody.
Kathy was on earlier on, and I read out her text. I'll just read it to you again. Alan is right. We have pathologized anxiety, sadness, loneliness, failure, all everyday human emotions.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned anxiety. Anxiety is an interesting one. If you drill, I mean, forgive me for doing this because I'm coming very much, very influenced by psychotherapy. But, you know, psychotherapists come up with an interesting rule that anxiety, when you're very anxious about something, a good thing to think about is the catastrophe you think is going to happen has probably already happened to you at a time when you didn't know how to cope,
right,
when you didn't even know how to understand, and probably in ways that you've forgotten. So your anxiety is not so much a prediction for your future. It's a retrospect. It's a glimpse of what you've been through, but don't know about. So one of the best ways to reduce anxiety is to go, how's your life been difficult in the past? Not, you know, let's put aside what you're, you know, all the demons you're imagining. What is this scenario telling us about your past? Because there's a vital clue in your sense of the future about actually what happened in your past.
Mm. You cite things like politeness, kindness, staring out a window, that we need to re-recognize, I think that's the word you used, rekindle. So where is kindness, politeness, where have they gone?
We make a case for some of these kind of old-fashioned virtues. Politeness has gone because we tend to think nowadays that we need to let everyone know what we're actually feeling at every moment. So if I'm feeling angry, I'm just going to tell you in exactly the way. Now, this could contradict what I was saying a minute ago, but you know, what we need to do is to find a way to get across the deepest truths of who we are in a way that's not going to damage another person. And what we call a so-called rude person is somebody who hasn't understood the sensitivity of another person, probably because no one understood sensitivity towards them at some key formative point. And so I think we often forget how much little things hurt people. You know, we our day can be ruined by a slightly you know, off remark from somebody. And we do this to people without noticing, but we certainly notice when they do it to us. So greater sensitivity about the way we're maneuvering through the world. It's interesting you mentioned, I read this an essay about in praise of looking out of the window. Now you could say, well, what on earth is that about? Well, you know, one of the things we find very hard in the modern world is to spend time with our own minds. You were talking about social media earlier. Our capacities for being distracted and for being constantly kind of surrounded by noise is more than ever. And one of the things we find it hardest to do is just to sit still with the contents of our own minds. And the reason we do this, we find it so hard, is we're scared. Because when you're sitting on your own, you might encounter a regret, a longing, maybe an undigested bit of envy, something. And we don't want to deal with those things. But in a way, you can't grow unless you've had a look at these things. And that's why all
spiritual
discipline...
So what do you do with them then? What do you do with them, these thoughts that are rushing around our brains?
I think you need to be prepared for how awkward it will feel and then go for it. Go for sitting on your own with a pad of paper, working out, you know, what's exciting you at the moment? What's made you sad at the moment? What happened today? You know, we probably need about 10 minutes of processing for every 4 or 5 hours of living. And we don't give ourselves even a fraction of that. We need to process our emotions. And as I say, you don't need to become a great writer. All you need is a pad and paper and a willingness to jot stuff down so that you can start to see the patterns that are kind of emerging. And we don't allow ourselves that time. And a lot of insomnia, you know, people go, I can't sleep at night, etc. I think insomnia is ultimately a kind of revenge on the part of all those thoughts that you manage not to have during the day. And they're coming back at you at 3 a.m. demanding to be heard, because that's the thing about thoughts. They need a hearing.
Do you think we're increasingly ill-equipped to cope with the modern world? Like, that we have changed our environment so much that we haven't caught up with it?
I think that's right, in part. Look, I think that religions used to take care of the inner life, and then we've done away with religion now. Now we are, you know,
there's a lot of people still.
Of course. But as a dominant way of understanding human experience, religion has moved into the private realm. And so a lot of people are saying, okay, I don't believe in a higher God. I don't believe in a higher thing. I'm on my own. I'm not reading the Bible, etc. You know, and there's no particular guidance. The only thing you're supposed to care about is, you know, your primary sexual relationship and then your career. And those are the things that are supposed to give your life meaning. And for most of us, getting our love lives right and our careers right are impossible tasks, because we're putting all expectations of a good life onto those things. In fact, life is a broader, richer thing. We're never going to have perfect understanding with one other human being who will redeem us totally in the way that we've done in our modern approach to relationships, whereby, incidentally, what we've done is essentially secularize all the expectations that we used to give of divine beings. Mm. I mean, nowadays, you know, it's no surprise that people call each other angel. But the problem is that our earthly angels that we're sharing bedrooms with are disappointing to us. So we get angry with them, and they're not the angel we thought they were. And then we divorce them and go to another angel. But what we need to do is to start to accept that, human beings are never going to satisfy each other perfectly in the way that romanticism tells us that we may. So, you know,
we're social beings. You know, we have our relationship with our chosen one, but we also live in a community, a society, wherever, and like religion did sort of hold that community together for, like, particularly say in a country like Ireland, it was the focus of parishes and towns and villages, its power has obviously been eroded quite substantially. So what fills that void?
Well, I think, you know, too often the debate has gone like this. Either you have religion and then, you know, you buy the whole thing, or else, you know, you move over and you're Richard Dawkins and you're a secular person and you know, everything's explained by science and on you go. And that, I think, is too stark a choice. I mean, I wrote a book about this a few years ago called Religion for Atheists, in which basically I tried to say, you know, what we need to do is to steal the best ideas of religions. The people who don't believe still need a lot of the things that religion used to give. We still need community. We still need let's face it, what philosophers like to call the transcendent, an experience of the transcendent. In other words, an experience of something that is bigger than human beings. Part of the reason why we're
driven mad. Why do we need that?
Yeah, we so need that because, you know, we're all jostling for position. We're all getting upset about who's bigger than who and, you know, this guy got ahead and this person's doing this, etc. And it's wonderful if we can leave the city, if we can leave the experience of other human beings in the kind of human beehive and step outside, look at the giant sky above us, look at ancient trees, look at the ocean, something that is mightier, bigger, older.
So you're talking about nature.
Well, yes, and more broadly, everything that is non-human, an experience of the non-human. We're the first society ever to have put the human being only at the center of our societies, that we don't worship anything else. You know, it's all about us. And that drives you crazy. I mean, that's why nowadays we need, you know, dogs more than ever before. You don't need, you know, the good thing about a dog is when you have a dog, it doesn't mind how you're doing at work. It doesn't care about your relationship. It just wants to take a ball and go for a run. Or little children, you know, children under five, they don't care how much money you're making. They care if you're nice. They care if you're going to play with them, etc. We need those basic reminders because the human anthill is such a pressured place.
It's a fascinating read. It'll make people question themselves in a real way. Just to go back to where we started, lifting the lid on our true thoughts. That's dangerous enough, is it? Is it not dangerous enough?
You know, there's always a kind of apprehension, and we spend so much time, you know, in what psychotherapists call denial, which is elaborate strategies to run away from ideas we don't want to have. That's what addiction is. You know, we hear a lot about addiction. You know, almost always what addiction ultimately is not somebody who kind of loves drugs or loves overeating or whatever. It's somebody who has a pain they can't confront. And the reason they can't confront is that no one's held their hand in order to walk towards that pain. And that's what we need. We need a helping hand. In a gentle way, this book is a kind of helping hand. It's trying to model a voice of self-compassion, self-understanding that hopefully the reader can take into the rest of their lives. But we're so alone with all of this stuff. I mean, I can't stress to you how much loneliness is a problem in the modern world. It's not that we don't have anyone to see for dinner. Maybe we have got someone to see for dinner, although often we might don't even have that. But it's that who we really are, it seems there's no echo. We can't communicate with other people at the depth we need to. There's an epidemic of loneliness out there, and we escape it through, you know, through drugs, through alcohol, through addiction to the news, through the latest update on Brexit. You know, ultimately our responsibility is to our own lives, to our own fulfillment, and to our own friendship circle.
On that, we won't have time to talk about this, but I'll point people towards the Charity of Interpretation, which really struck me, and it's something that I'm going to try and change in my life. Alan de Botton, thank you very much for talking to us. The School of Life and Emotional Education is Alan's new book. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you so much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.